This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. In East Chicago, there is an activist who has found what some may consider a very unique way to show his support and in turn hope to make some change with the problem of homelessness here in Northwest Indiana. And with us to tell us more about it and more about a very interesting church called Grace Beyond Borders is Marcus Martin. Marcus, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me here, and I appreciate this opportunity to share just some of the things that's going on in Northwest Indiana that a lot of people are not aware of.
Take a moment, if you will, first just briefly describe what Grace Beyond Borders Northwest Indiana is all about.
Yes, we're a nonprofit, 501c nonprofit organization, and we had our this initiation in 2013, in which we began to, for over these last 6 years, rescue homeless women, children, and men out of deplorable, unsafe, unsanitary conditions by offering them a hand up, not a handout.
How serious is the problem of homelessness here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, from our 6 years of on the streets. See, we spend a lot of time on the streets making connections with homeless individuals and with citizens who are very much aware of what's really going on with homelessness. And we uncovered just huge problem that was being ignored or not, people were not aware of what's really going on by the number of homelessness that we encountered. And just from May till now, it's been a tsunami of homeless women with children who are seeking emergency help, and it's just not there. In East Chicago, there is not any type of emergency shelter or transitional housing for individuals who are homeless.
I know that you have described in one media account that the homeless are our invisible neighbor. And explain, if you will, please, why you feel that way.
Yes, they are neighbors because, one, they're part of our community, and they are often hidden for two reasons. One, people ignore them. They tend not to look or make eye contact with individuals who they deem may be homeless. Or the second thing is a lot of people who are homeless are embarrassed and ashamed of their situation, not ever planning to be homeless. And something happened in their life where unemployment, domestic violence, medical hardship propelled them into homelessness. So because of the embarrassment and shame, they just do not want to be identified as being homeless. Oftentimes, they're right in our company, and because they don't look homeless, we think they don't exist. So they're invisible.
I know we've heard accounts of even going to young people who are homeless, family members who are homeless, and youngsters going to school, and it seems at least to everybody around them, particularly at school, that there's nothing wrong, except that there's really is something wrong, that there's that maybe the young person relies on the meals he gets or she gets at school because there is no place at home to be able to have a regular meal, and then staying at home basically means staying in a shelter.
Well, when you are a school-age child, you have the school as a place to not only get a meal but also to wash up, especially if you're in a situation which we have been alerted of as individuals who are sleeping in their vehicles with their children, those who don't have any other place to of any type of refuge or shelter. So you have to wash up. You have to maintain your cleanliness, or otherwise you can get teased or bullied. So school could be arriving at school very early, leaving late, opportunities where a person can actually wash up. You got your fast food restaurants. People tend to wash up. They go inside one of the stalls, lock the door, and they're able to change clothes and wash up. See, these things are going on under our nose, and many people just don't pay attention, or we don't care, or we're not concerned. But I have a campaign, A Night Without a Home, for 30 days, where I'm going out overnight and sleeping in the various locations where a homeless population is sleeping now, or they have slept. These are locations they have revealed to us. Mm-hmm. Through Grace Beyond Borders.
So, what places have you been able to spend overnights in?
Wow, some of the tough ones: under a bridge, mm-hmm. A few yards from the railroad tracks, on a picnic table at a popular park, on the seating area of a picnic table in another park, an abandoned house. I should say a vacant house, because it was owned by individual I knew, and another a vacant property, and also in my vehicle. And one of the creative ways, a college student, a mom, whose husband had his hands around her neck trying to choke her to death in front of her 4-year-old, so she chose to be homeless to escape that situation and could not find any shelter. So she got her daughter into a safe place, and she had her personal vehicle, so she would park at night in the garage of one of the local hospitals, where there's lighting and a sense of safety there. And that's the kind of, you have to be creative. You have to sleep somewhere at night, and it can be very uncomfortable being on the streets exposed to whatever situations may be out there.
I know there's one example that you give about these places where I guess what you could say the not so hidden homeless are staying in abandoned buildings. They're not vacant because it's where a lot of homeless people stay. You describe us what one of these homes that has been occupied on Elm Street looks like. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a two-story house, and some homeless individuals were able to gain access to the house through the window of the basement, or through the back window near the porch area. And so you figure they are out of the elements, and they have they had a number of different rooms there. It was, I believe, a 2-bedroom house, I know downstairs and upstairs. Mm-hmm. So you have a number of people can stay in there. Then you had the bedrooms had doors, so you can have a number of individuals, even couples, who are staying in that type of setting. And these are individuals that pretty much know each other, and from time to time they are able to gather together and say, hey, we have a place here. There's no light. There isn't any light at night, and there's not any running water or heat, so there's no utilities, but it's a place where they can lie down at night, close their eyes, because there's simply not anything else available. And we want to turn that around, and that's what our campaign is doing now, to reach the individuals who have a heart, who, if they know about this situation, will not allow individuals to sleep in those type of settings, that would respond and give a small donation, just skip a meal, one meal out the month, and this one meal, which could be a $5, you know, fast food or restaurant meal, and donate that to Grace Beyond Border.
We're talking with Marcus Martin, executive director and founder of an organization called Grace Beyond Borders. They're located in East Chicago, and I understand this is really a kind of an outgrowth of what you had done as a volunteer for a church in Chicago, the Apostolic Church of God. They've been very involved, I guess, on volunteer level for some time with the homeless, and certainly in the Chicago area, and you find it's the same problem everywhere, apparently.
Yes. You know, it was a real eye-opener for me when I started back in 2001 with our homeless outreach ministry in Chicago. I mean, it's a good example. I see people on the streets but not realizing how many people are actually homeless unless you're at a homeless shelter there. And then you see the number of people going in there. I just had no idea. And then when I looked at Indiana, it's different. you're not seeing people who are camped out, you know, in certain areas. You don't see tents and you don't see mattresses and things. But we had to, as we worked over the last 6 years, we began to ask a question, where are you sleeping? And that's when we started identifying the different multiple locations individuals have slept.
Do you find in talking with folks, regardless whether it's in Chicago or here in Northwest Indiana, that with the problem of homelessness being so pervasive all over, not only our region, but all over the country, that that the efforts to help support these people are pretty much the same, that if you're offering hope and love and care as well for all these folks and for food and clothing and lodging for those that need it the most, that it seems to give them hope and in turn will maybe possibly help turn some of their lives around?
Well, let me give you an example. Back in 2015, I met a woman during my outreach on the streets, which we did a lot of. That's where the contact is made, on the streets. And this young woman would participate in what we call our Celebrate Recovery program. And she had a heroin addiction and also abusive relationship. And off and on, she would come and, you know, be involved with our program, and we just poured the love of God all over her, and then she disappeared. But back in September, she came in, and she had hit bottom. She said she was tired, and she knew what she needed to do, and we encouraged her, and she is doing this super great right now. She just finished up a 60-day initial recovery program, treatment program in South Bend, where we assisted her with transportation to get there. And then also she is enrolled in a long-term recovery program. And that's critical.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it takes. And she is just so determined, and she communicates with me every week, and, you know, two or three times out the week. She's all over my Facebook page. Just with words of encouragement. But that's an example. When you give a person an opportunity and you open up the door and you deal with a total person, mind, body, spirit, then you give them a chance. You give them hope to move out of their situation, because that woman also had a story of this adverse childhood experience,
mm-hmm.
of rape during her, you know, by a relative.
Right.
So, and abuse, you know, constant. So rising over all that requires not just a place for them to lay their head down, to lie down, but a place where they can begin to heal. They can, you know, things in their lives can be restored, and they can actually get hope to move to the next level. And that's what we do.
It's interesting that you should mention about helping find places for homeless people to stay on a long-term basis, in particular the fact that you're even arranging transportation. Are you finding that the opportunities for homeless shelter options don't happen to be around our area, that you do sometimes have to take somebody to a faraway city to be able to get them to stay in someplace comfortable and more secure?
Most definitely. You have to have places have to have that type of staffing and type of service available. We deal mainly with my mentors, which is the Rescue Mission in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Also, we've had success with Wheeler Rescue Mission in Indianapolis, and on the Illinois side, Aurora Wayside Mission, because they all offer long-term, and that's critical. It takes time for people to heal and to be restored from just some of the traumas in their lives. They just can't get a quick 8-week fix and put back out on the streets and say, okay, we gave you 8 weeks, next. It has to be where they have some time in which they can grow, which they can, you know, overcome some of the hardships in their life that weren't supposed to be there.
I know that last year that you had an effort going where you were trying to and a goal to raise some money to be able to purchase property in East Chicago, be able to turn it into an emergency home, the shelter, with the kind of services by the trained staff to actually help people become more self-reliant. But you ran into some difficulties then. Are you finding that the goal is still there? It's just maybe taken a different form with this this 30-day campaign of A Night Without a Home?
Great question. The goal is still there. The property's not still there, but we missed that opportunity. But that's okay. There's other properties we will locate in East Chicago, and we do have significant support. We do have to grow some more support. Again, we're reaching out to 8,000 people, just skipping one restaurant meal each month and donating that $5, and just donate that to what we're doing, and we will have those operational dollars that we need, and we can move on. And so we have if I can say now, we do have a place where they can donate. That would be the www.thefaceofgrace. I can't forget the T-H-E. thefaceofgrace.org, and there's opportunity to donate there. Also, they can send their, and we do receive checks and money orders at our Grace Beyond Borders post office box, 927 East Chicago, Indiana, 46312. And one important thing, if they really want to see what we're doing, they can go on Facebook and follow. I do live videos from the different locations that I spend the night. And so they can really see the actual locations where our homeless individuals, they never even paid attention to or thought that individuals would find this as a refuge from or shelters from the weather conditions, but also safety. Safety from whatever situations they could be encountered on the streets. But, you're sleeping and somebody come along. I mean, people do rob people. In fact, one of our clients decided to sleep at a bus stop shelter and was awakened after midnight with a gun at his head, demanding his wallet. And he's homeless, he didn't have any money, and so they struck him in the head with the gun.
Oh, that's sad to hear.
And he was just trying to have a place to, he didn't have there's not a shelter, so he just found that as he thought it was okay.
Well, Marcus, out there. Marcus, thank you very much for spending some time to talk with us about your campaign that's underway right now, A Night Without a Home, and the efforts that Grace Beyond Borders is doing in East Chicago and all of Northwest Indiana in particular, even branching as far away as South Bend as need be to help find homeless residents a place to stay that they feel safe and warm and comfortable in. And we hope to have a chance to check back and see how the campaign's coming along. We appreciate you spending time, Marcus, to talk with us today about it.
Okay.
Marcus Martin is the executive director of an organization called Grace Beyond Borders. It's based in East Chicago, and they're doing their best to help find homes for homeless people in Northwest Indiana. One note to the conversation with Marcus, the most important item that homeless folks say that they need are socks, going along with keeping their feet warm. And underway now through Friday, December 21st, the Gary Police Department is collecting new socks and pajamas in sizes infant to adult to be able to support the local homeless shelters. There are donation boxes set up, and one of them is at the Gary Police Department lobby, which is at 555 Polk Street in Gary. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Prevention is an important piece in the addiction crisis puzzle. A new substance abuse prevention program in Indiana is aiming to address the risk of addiction through personality assessment. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the goal is to give young people the tools to strengthen their mental wellness and resistance.
Aaron Phillips died from a drug overdose when he was 20. His mom, Justin Phillips, has dedicated her life to preventing others from the same fate.
He was so sensitive.
She remembers his personality traits.
This was a kid that skateboarded off the top of my house onto the van in the driveway, so I think there was some risk-taking going on there, too.
Sensitivity, impulsivity, and anxiety are some of the personality traits targeted by a new prevention education program that Phillips introduced through her nonprofit Overdose Lifeline. Phillips says the goal is to arm students with tools.
No one ever talks to anyone about anxiety. And we never talk about how to deal, cope appropriately with anxiety.
Overdose Lifeline has presented the program to 13 schools in 6 low-income Indiana counties. It's called Prevention.
Changing the way that we think. So recognizing, first of all, that you have impulsivity and what it looks like, what it feels like internally, what the thoughts might be around that personality.
The Indiana Division of Mental Health and Addictions supports Prevention through a grant and pilot project. Students are identified through a screening and then can participate in 2 90-minute workshops. Families can opt out. Savvy Brinica is one of the program facilitators with Overdose Lifeline.
We're teaching them that you do have control over your thoughts.
That if you're in a bad spot,
you don't have to be a product of the event happening. Rather, your thoughts are malleable. You can change the way that you're thinking to ultimately change your behavior.
Research shows the younger a person starts using drugs, the more likely they could become addicted. There's still limited study about the Prevention program approach, but Brinica says the Indiana pilot will add data.
Compare the students who enroll in the program and their substance use and overall mental health quality to the rest of the student population who doesn't participate. It's about their overall mental health.
But it can be a hard sell. In rural Grant County, Principal Pat McLaughlin at Eastbrook High School says they initially had some pushback.
Because it's talking about addiction prevention and just the negative connotation maybe that parents would have that, well, my kid doesn't do that or wouldn't do that.
All of his ninth graders were screened through the program and none of the students opted out. There's a growing awareness of the importance of social and emotional learning. McLaughlin says his students need support.
They're talking about their home life, they're, you know, not having running water at home or heat or things like that, and then trying to come to school, and we're trying to educate them with all of those things that they brought with them to school.
Root causes like poverty and other adverse childhood experiences can contribute to the risk of substance use disorder. Jackie Crane is a school nurse. She helped bring the Prevention program to Seymour High School.
If there's any kind of trauma in a child's life, then if they're not given the right tools, they're going to go down this path.
Crane's son has struggled with heroin addiction. She says she gets it, why young people start using.
You're in a bad mood and you're just so anxious, you know, that you can't, that nobody's listening to you and you feel like you don't have a voice, so you need something to calm yourself down.
Crane says her son would have benefited from the mental health tools provided through this school program before years of addiction, arrests, and now recovery.
Taylor's 27, and he is just now learning coping skills from the programs that he's been in now.
Overdose Lifeline hopes to train more school districts to implement the Prevention program. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In a recent edition, a quarterly edition, we actually should say, of the Indiana Policy Review, because an article that was put out by a guest on our program in the past from Ken Davidson, who, of course, puts out the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog, talking about economic data that the state of Indiana seems to hold close to the vest, as was put in the headline that was in the article. And we have Ken Davidson with us to talk more about it and bring us up to date on some of the concerns about how governmental agencies, not only here in the region, but apparently across the state, are not quite as transparent as they probably should be. Ken, thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And let's talk first here about the article that was in the quarterly Indiana Policy Review. You focused in on that in particular on a statewide basis, I guess, about whether the state's Department of Local Government Finances is really offering up the information on where money folks in not only Northwest Indiana, but elsewhere in the state, put in as tax dollars that go toward economic development. Tell us the background about that article.
Sure. So for a couple of years now, I've been trying to follow and determine economic development spending within Lake County. And so back in 2015, 2016, I discovered the statewide TIF viewer on the Gateway. The Gateway, if the listeners haven't checked it out, is a great resource for a lot of information. And so the tax increment finance viewer used to have information on every county, and then you could sort all of the TIFs within that county based on a number of criteria, but I would primarily sort them based on the issuing unit, which would then let you scroll down through the cities. So in Lake County, Crown Point would be first, and then you would have Dyer, and then East Chicago, and you could just scroll through and look at all of them for each unit of government. And so in 2015, there was an article written by Ball State, and there have been several articles that are critical of the overuse of TIF. And but this one in particular was a seminal article written by Michael Hicks at Ball State, and they analyzed TIF data from throughout the state and found that, in general, what tax increment financing does is moves around economic development a little bit. It doesn't really create any new economic development. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. But that was the gist of the article. Shortly after that, the data became unavailable.
For folks that may not be aware of what TIF is, it's short for tax increment financing. But what basically does that do for a community or for a township or a county government?
Okay, so let's the best way to explain what tax increment financing is to number one, take a look at what I would consider a somewhat, just on its surface, a somewhat successful TIF district and an idea of what it's supposed to do. So if people are familiar with Ameriplex and Portage, that was an empty field, and they needed some roads, and they needed some sewers, and they needed increased infrastructure. And then somebody would come in, and they would build office space or warehouse space or whatever it is you want to build over there. And so I think the city of Portage spent about $4 million in that TIF district, putting in the roads on vacant land. And then they built, in that particular case, there's primarily warehousing in the back there. And at this point in time, the $4 million has long been paid back, and there are hundreds of jobs in that area. That, in my opinion, is a successful TIF. Now, let's back up one step. That money, once the TIF is laid down, all future increases in tax revenues go to a redevelopment commission, which is generally, in most cases, an unelected board appointed by the mayor of the city. In a town, they're obviously appointed by the town council. But you get three appointments by the mayor and two by the city council, which shifts the balance of power from the city council, which is generally responsible for budgeting issues, right? And so now the mayor has control over that portion of the budget because he has three appointments and the city council has two. And so it's a tool. It's a useful tool. Any tool can be abused. You know, I like to analogize, if I am building something in my home, a hammer could be a useful tool. But if I just go in and start whack-a-moling the walls, that's not really a good use of a tool.
Mm-hmm. What has it turned out that in turn following through here, even looking through what's happened here in Lake County, some response from some other communities too, I imagine, as to whether they're getting the best use for the tax increment finance districts in their community too?
Certainly. And so we have huge increases in spending in TIFs at the same time that we have referendums for our schools. Schools are dependent on property tax revenue for their transportation funds and for their capital improvement funds. So, you know, if you want to build a new school, if your school needs a new roof, those kinds of things, those are all paid for out of property taxes. And in many of our communities, any property that's really worth anything is in a TIF. If you look at residential, which generally, although in Hammond, where I live, there's a lot of residential in the TIF. Since 1995, residential is not supposed to be included in the TIF. But if you look at the fact that commercial properties pay 3% in taxes and residential properties generally pay 1% after a homestead, there's a significant difference between how much is getting put into the TIF and how much is not.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at Munster, for instance. Munster's TIF runs the entire length of Calumet Avenue, if you're familiar with the area, from one end of the town to the other, and then all of the area along Sheffield, Community Estates, Three Floyds would be in there, the Times would be in there, all the way over to State Line is all in a TIF, with the residential area cut out, as it should be, and then all the way up and down Ridge Road. So pretty much anything that's commercial in Munster is in a TIF.
Yeah.
And that's not unusual for the region.
Are we finding, and you probably discovered as well, too, that in these cases here, because you had some areas that have it set up TIF districts to benefit the commercial and any industrial zoned areas, that we have residential areas that been planned in that way, or did it just turn out accidentally to be in it?
Well, again, prior to 1995, it was okay to include the residential within the TIF. And so Gary, Hammond, and New Chicago have a significant amount of residential within the TIF district. I don't know exactly the reason for that, but in my, again, this is my opinion, that's particularly troublesome because those homes are sending children to the schools, but the schools are not then getting the tax revenue from those homes.
One of the other questions that you brought up, not only that's in the article in the Indiana Policy Review, the quarterly edition that's out, but you also have brought up on your own blog site, is talking about the importance of the transparency issue about contracts with businesses or I guess other entities, I suppose, and governments, in particular city and town governments here. What you mentioned some of these, I know in the article that you had in that was published in the quarterly review, and you talk about it, of course, as you say in your blog site here. What seems to be the case as far as whether this information that's not making it out there for public review, is there anything that can be done about it? Is there any state law that tells that you're not supposed to be holding it back?
Sure. Let's review real quick for the listeners. It's sides of the same coin, right? First of all, the money, we need to take a look at how much money is going in and how much money they're borrowing. So that's the revenue side. But then when we look at the spending side and try to find some transparency on the spending side, we see that there is this law that says that they have to publish any contract over $50,000, right? And this is true for any unit of government. It's not just the commission. But nobody's doing it. And so I shouldn't say nobody. There are very few people who are complying with the law. Even those who are complying with the law, it would appear to me, are not completely complying with the law. It's hard to believe that they have that few contracts over $50,000. So, for instance, Lake County hasn't uploaded anything in months. There's all this revenue going in, and then when we say, hey, where did that money go? The only way to find out is to go to a meeting of an elected board at 10 o'clock on a Thursday morning.
And it's a convenience issue, I suppose. The average citizen that may have questions or at least would like to know has to go out of their way to be able to find out.
Well, in private conversations, and you know, this is something that I would encourage all media to take a look at, if you talk to even elected officials, they have no idea what's going on. You know, they can't give you numbers as far as how much in professional services contracts were handed out. There are lots of no-bid contracts being handed out, which, you know, deserve particular scrutiny, I think, because you don't have the protection of that bidding process. And so it's not just, you know, the average citizen who doesn't even know where to look. Even elected officials who possibly know where to look have no idea what's going on because it's just become almost impossible to track.
Does it look like to you that there may be a possibility, I guess it would depend on which brave lawmaker wants to take it up, that it may come up maybe someday in a measure that will be before the General Assembly?
Well, unfortunately, right now it seems to be going the other way. You know, I mean, the statute that requires them to publish contracts over $50,000 is relatively new. It was passed in 2016. More and more communities are complying with it. And I think I mentioned in the article that when I talked to Michael Griffin in Highland, he said, oh, you know what? We were going to do that. We just haven't gotten to it yet. And we'll do it now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Michael Griffin. That's how he always is. you bring something to his attention, he either agrees or disagrees with you, and he has a good reason for doing it. So Highland is now published. When I went to the school city of Hammond and asked Monica Conrad about it, she said the same thing. You're right, we'll get them on. And so they started publishing. So some awareness of it, possibly, and this is one of the reasons I thank you so much for having me on to discuss this, is that the more people know about it and the more people question, you know, where is this information, you may see more of it. But as long as people don't know, then they're sort of blissfully ignorant. It's a shiny new building, and you know, hey, look at that. How'd they do that?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope that it piques some people's curiosity in law, especially if they're going through their community and they see some new construction underway. Yeah, and if they understand this in a particular, like in the TIF districts, they can certainly be able to find out and should be able to find out which area is getting the funds and why the tax dollars might be funneled to these particular projects as opposed to going to help schools and other governmental agencies as well, too. Well, Ken, thank you
absolutely
very much. Thanks for spending
some
time.
One final thought, if I could. Local businesses who might be impacted by this. So, for instance, in Hammond, we had Micklertz was here for 50 years or however long they were here. Well, they ultimately were put out of business because Cabela's was given a lot of incentives to come to town. Mm-hmm. The local business owners should be particularly mindful of this. And people who enjoy going to those local businesses, because generally the national franchises that are getting this money in these redevelopment plans.
Well, Ken, thanks for that bit of advice there, and thank you for talking with us today about this. Ken Davison puts out, of course, the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog, and he's also had an article that's been published in one of the quarterly issues of the Indiana Policy Review talking about how more transparency is needed in government funded programs like tax increment financing districts. You're listening to Regionally Speaking. The Lake County Council will come back tomorrow morning for a historic one-time meeting in the building where they used to originally begin holding meetings, the historic Lake County Courthouse in downtown Crown Point. The managing director of the Courthouse Foundation, Carrie Napoleon, talked with us not long ago about this very special meeting tomorrow, talking first about how the idea for the meeting actually began.
You know, I worked for the Post Tribune for a while and covered county government. And after I took this job with the Courthouse Foundation, Councilman Dan Dernault had come to the building for some unrelated business and just saw how beautiful it is. And it really is a beautiful structure. So we started talking, and you know, he posed the idea, what if we came back? So we worked on it a bit, him, Dave Hamm, and we kind of made it all happen, and we're really excited to have them. They won't be meeting where they originally met back in the 70s. The room is very small. I had spoken with Bill Dolan from the Times regarding this, and he had actually covered county government when it was back at Courthouse Building and said people would be standing in the hallway trying to peer in because it was so crowded. The courtroom is spectacular. This is the circuit courtroom. It was added in the first expansion, or it was enlarged, I should say, in the first expansion in 1909. All the seating is original in there. It's truly beautiful. We use it now. Crown Point City Court was there until about 2 years ago. Now we use it exclusively for weddings, ceremonies. It really is spectacular. It has the 16-foot windows. It's just a gorgeous space.
Besides getting things set up for the county council meeting, have they got planned for that room that day?
Hopefully, we have a lot of folks from the community show up. We're really proud of the building and would like to kind of share what we have there to show people around. You know, we'll be providing tours that day. We'll have some coffee and refreshments for anybody who shows up. And the council will be conducting its regular business meeting. You know, we'll take the normal amount of time that it usually does. I'm sure they have, I haven't seen an agenda, but I'm sure they have a lot of business to conduct being end of year and all. So it should be an interesting day.
Is there any reason why they happened to pick this particular meeting, I guess, to hold this historic one-time only meeting outside of the county government center?
Timing, and it's past budget season. While we were in budget season when we originally started talking about this, all those meetings are set well in advance, and you really can't change anything when it comes to dealing with the budget. So this was a little easier. It was notified 2 months ago, so people had time to make the adjustment, and it typically they say that this isn't as busy of an agenda at the end of the year, but they're always busy. People see the Crown Point Courthouse and think, oh, it's always been there. You know, it's a beautiful structure. It looks fantastic. But it's important to remember this is a 140-year-old building. We marked our 140th birthday this year. And every day there is something. It needs constant maintenance and restoration, or it's not going to last into the future. So it's an ongoing battle to keep the funds coming in, to keep things up to date, keep things improved, keep things moving. So the more awareness we raise about this, the more people we bring into the building so they feel a connection to it. It was easy in the 70s because people had been through there a lot. Now, unless you're invited to a wedding or if you shop in our shop, you may not see the second and third floor. A lot of people do go downstairs to the shops. We are at full occupancy down there and decorated for the holidays, so it's a really exciting time down there. But people often don't travel upstairs and see just the beautiful marble work, the engraving, the founders of the county who are engraved in the walls. It's really an interesting building.
Tomorrow's historic one-time-only Lake County Council meeting in the third floor courtroom of the downtown courthouse will begin at 10 a.m.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Soundbites is sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase. Welcome to the second-to-last installment of Quantum Leap Soundbites. All season long, we've circled around a big question. What exactly is Hoosier Ingenuity? Why have so many STEM innovations happened here? This month in December, we're going to spend two episodes visiting one Northeast Indiana city, where many critical innovations have taken place. Fort Wayne. Taking a closer look at how Fort Wayne has paved the way for modern entertainment and communication as we know them today may help us answer our larger question. Why has Indiana been a hotbed of scientific and technological invention and ingenuity? In 2018, we have seemingly endless ways to connect to one another. Our smartphones, computers, internet, television, and movies all provide entertainment as well as immediate connectivity to each other. Information can travel across the world instantly, and we have more opportunities to connect than ever before. It's strange to imagine all of the ways that the world was different before this level of connection. As we've explored in many episodes thus far, scientists used to have to travel for weeks sometimes to get together once a year to share progress and results. Now we have the results of millions of science experiments digitally available for anyone to read and expand upon at any time. Daily newspapers used to be the primary way we received our news, hours and sometimes days later. Now we can find out what's happening around the world in real time, in our homes or on the go. In this two-part episode, we'll meet the Hoosiers that have sparked this dramatic shift in the way we live our lives. Each invention that we're covering, the electric television, the transistor radio, and the first video game console, were all Hoosier inventions, and each has inspired hundreds, possibly thousands more innovations that have led to modern life as we know it. But first, let's go back in time. Why were these vital pieces of technology all invented or manufactured for the first time in the same place, Fort Wayne? Much of it stems from the work of a chemist named George Jacobs. At the turn of the century, in 1901, George worked in the General Electric factory in Fort Wayne. At this point in history, electronics were relatively new and were more industrial items, not personal items. Radios used vacuum tubes for power, and vacuum tubes looked like very large light bulbs and were at the time the most reliable way to create an electromagnetic field within an object like radio or television. But there was a problem. Vacuum tubes were pretty large, and there wasn't really a way to make them smaller. So the engineers and scientists who wanted to bring electronics to the everyday person were struggling because they couldn't figure out a reliable way to conduct electricity and electromagnetic fields within small spaces. Until George Jacobs figured it out. He figured out how to take an item that conducts electricity in small spaces, but was very unstable and dangerous, and worked and worked and worked until he found a way to make it stable. The conductor is called magnet wire, and is composed of strands of metal like copper or aluminum that can be coiled tightly and energized to create electromagnetic fields. At the time, magnet wire was insulated with cloth, which was very unstable and dangerous. But George worked for years, constantly tinkering and perfecting his secret recipe to coat the magnet wire in an enamel insulation so that it could be safely and reliably used in small electronics and motors. In 1912, his father-in-law, a Fort Wayne local, invested in opening up a plant on Wall Street, where he and several employees began producing his special enameled magnet wire for the world. Magnet wire helped create a snowball effect on innovation in Fort Wayne. A number of companies in the automotive and electronic industries opened up shop in Fort Wayne so they could be near magnet wire suppliers. 15 years after George Jacobs began producing his enameled magnet wire in Fort Wayne full-time, another man, Philo Farnsworth, demonstrated the first fully electronic television. Philo worked and experimented for over 5 years before a fateful day on September 7, 1927, when Philo transmitted the first electronic television image to his staff that said, "The damn thing works!" According to his biographer, Paul Shatskin, Philo was the first to form and manipulate an electron beam, and that accomplishment represents a quantum leap in human knowledge that is still in use today. By 1938, Philo was searching for the best place to have a manufacturing plant for Farnsworth Television and Radio Corporation and decided on Fort Wayne. His company was a financial success and quickly pivoted to military projects for the government. Both George and Philo made huge contributions to our modern world of communication and entertainment. The inventions of insulated magnet wire and the first electric television each set off innovation explosions of their own, and our communication landscape has changed dramatically since then. However, one thing hasn't changed. Fort Wayne is still a hotbed of electric connectivity and innovation. If you've been following this series since the beginning, it's no surprise that Indiana has and is producing innovations that change the world. It's just one of the reasons Indiana Humanities launched the Quantum Leap theme and in this podcast. Catch us in 2 weeks for the second part of this mini-series and the final Soundbites episode to learn about additional Fort Wayne inventions, the first transistor radio, and the first video game console. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by J.P. Morgan Chase, and I'm Sandra Burton.
And it's time for Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Don Parker, a musician and board member.
Yes.
Volunteer with the South Shore Orchestra, headquartered in, is it still headquartered in
Valparaiso? Valparaiso,
basically.
Yes. Yep.
And Don, have you been with the South Shore Orchestra since its inception?
Pretty much from the beginning, about 15 years now.
Yeah. So, and you all do how many approximately concerts per year?
Usually two concerts a year, every once in a while, three.
And when do you, where do you perform them?
Always at the Memorial Opera House. We are the house orchestra or home orchestra for the Memorial Opera House in Valparaiso.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a wonderful partnership that we've been able to do with them. The stage is a bit cozy for a full 50 or 60 piece orchestra, but we enjoy the house and we enjoy the audiences.
Yeah. And how big is the house? Part
about
of the-
310, 320. Something like that.
Yeah, that's nice.
So it's a nice sized house. It fills up nicely for the concerts, and everybody has a good time. Everybody has a good view of the stage, and the acoustics are wonderful.
And it's a beautiful little theater.
Yeah.
And historical.
1892, I believe, or 93.
Yeah.
The Marx Brothers performed there, and John Philip Sousa, of course, as everybody in this area knows, because VU's band does their annual Sousa concert there. So there's a plug for them.
There. That's big of you. Okay, so let's plug your upcoming concert. It's your holiday concert.
Holiday concert. Holiday Pops.
Holiday Pops, and what's on the program for the evening?
So it's a typical fun Pops concert for people. It's become kind of a tradition that we have, and a lot of Christmas carols, traditional things like, or I shouldn't say traditional, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer will have an appearance from Santa, as these concerts often do. And we have... we've been doing a season that's included Odorino Respighi music, a late classical composer, and he wrote a piece called The Fantastic Toy Shop, which is not the usual fare for these kinds of concerts. concerts, but it's a delightful piece of music. And so it'll be our little piece of true classical music in the concert.
Yeah. Well, he's most famous, I guess, for the Pines.
Pines of Rome and Fountains of Rome. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Which we did earlier this year.
Are these the Toys of Rome?
Could be. Sure. Why not?
Since he's Italian.
Since he's Italian. Exactly. Yeah.
And these are the kinds of concerts that are so popular, and people kind of flock to them. And
it's for a lot, even in Valparaiso has had orchestras off and on through the years, but we like to think that we're becoming Valparaiso's community orchestra, and that there are numbers of our fans that mark this concert and come and do this concert every year as an outing.
Well, and the university does quite a bit of Christmas programming as well.
They do.
Don't they?
Yep, they have a wonderful Christmas concert, which comes up in early December.
Is that absolutely in the chapel?
In the chapel.
Yeah,
yep.
I know. I've been to it in the past, but not for a while. And of course, Northwest Indiana Symphony is doing one performance of the Holiday Pops this year at the new high school auditorium.
So there's a lot of opportunities for people to come and see terrific holiday music. But if you're in Valparaiso, it's an easy get for your for a Christmas outing.
And the good thing about the Holiday Pops concerts is they help pay for the rest of the concerts at other times of the year.
Very true. We're like a lot of arts organizations. The popular music we do helps to pay for some of the more artsy stuff that doesn't have as wide an audience.
Mm-hmm. But the holiday time of year seems to be an impetus for people to attend a live performance, whether it be ballet, the Nutcracker.
Oh, and the Nutcracker
theater
is on our program again, as it often is. And you're right. It's a chance for people that think they don't like the arts to go and be a part of something that, in fact, they do like.
And it's a good reason to expose your kids to it, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they'll enjoy that music.
Recognizable stuff for them that it's easy for the kids to relate to.
Yeah. And it helps them, helps to solidify holiday traditions in their minds. And,
yeah,
it's a special time of the year. And it's gives in so many ways.
That's right.
Yes, not to be mercenary about it.
And it occurred to me we should actually say, I think we said the date, Friday, December 21st, and 7:30 at the Opera House.
So perfect timing right before Christmas.
Yep, exactly.
Excellent. Okay, Don. Well, thanks for being here to tell us about the Holiday Pops concert of the South Shore Orchestra. Good luck with it. And
thank you, John,
for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this and more conversations on Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. We'll be back with you tomorrow.